Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the news this week, Wall Street reform, volcano turmoil, and an environmental catastrophe. An oil rig went up in flames and sank in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers presumed dead. Here's one eyewitness boater who saw the inferno.
You could see it glowing from miles away. If it wasn't nighttime, you would have thought the sun was actually coming over the horizon. It was shining just that bright.
President Obama told Wall Street the time for financial reform is right now.
Without it, our house will continue to sit on shifting sands. And our families, businesses, and the global economy will be vulnerable to future crises.
And the Iceland volcano story dominated headlines. Many flights finally took off. Here's a weary German traveler on her way to Spain.
They told me my schedule is today, I fly. And the rest of the people who stranded, I don't know when they flying. So I hope God help me to get there.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines and you can join the conversation. What's moving your world this week? Are you with the president on financial reform or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from New York City is Diane Brady, senior editor for Bloomberg and Businessweek. Diane, great to have you back. Thanks.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
We expect to welcome Ed Luce, D.C. bureau chief for the Financial Times, shortly, we hope. Also with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Diane.
Let's begin with the big news front and center this week. President Obama going right to the heart of Wall Street to push for financial reform. I want to evaluate the president's speech and then get to the substance of the financial reform bill itself. Diane, how did the president do, to your mind?
Well, I think he's stuck with the theme that he's repeated for, well, let's say basically since the crisis started, that there was a culture of greed, that there's a failure of responsibility. And at this point, the motif everybody has is no more bailouts. We can't allow these guys to put our money at risk again, and no institution should be too big to fail. So I would characterize it as predictable, but obviously very important.
Here he is, President Obama in New York City yesterday, saying that the legislation being debated in the House and the Senate are worthy efforts. And the president asked Wall Street not to oppose reform.
Both bills represent significant improvement on the flawed rules that we have in place today. Despite the furious effort of industry lobbyists to shape this legislation to their special interests. And you know, for those of you in the financial sector, I'm sure that some of these lobbyists work for you, and they're doing what they are being paid to do. But I'm here today specifically when I speak to the titans of industry here, because I want to urge you to join us instead of fighting us in this effort.
Diane, Brady, this is your territory. How did Wall Street respond? How are they thinking about Obama's request?
Well, I think, again, they have seen it coming. Yes, there's a big lobbying effort afoot. But in essence, they do understand there's probably a need for more transparency, consumer protections they can live with. I think what really gets their rankles up is the pay reform, certainly, when we're looking at that, and the idea that no company should be too big to fail. So next time we won't bail you out, we'll just let you go under.
Jack Beatty, join us instead of fighting us in this effort to these Wall Street executives, the titans of Wall Street. What was in his tone? Did you see it as conciliatory, confrontational? What did you think?
Well, I think it could have been more confrontational. And, you know, he mentions the battalions of lobbyists. According to one measure, banks have been spending over $1 million a day now for some weeks lobbying. I saw statistics the other day that since 1989, Goldman Sachs has been the single largest contributor to the Democratic Party. And we know, of course, that it was among the largest contributors to President Obama's campaign in 2008. So there's a certain irony, isn't there, when the president, representing a party so deeply in hock to this industry, comes forward with regulations for the industry. And I'm persuaded by people like Simon Johnson, the former IMF bank economist, that these reforms don't go nearly far enough precisely because they do not do enough to break up the power of these banks. Six banks aggregate assets equivalent to 60% of our gross national product. That's incredible. And is there some great economic gain in having such behemoths? Not according to Paul Krugman, not according to Paul Volcker, not according to others. There's very little gain for the economy in this. But the damage and the danger for these of these large institutions is just so great that they need to be broken up. And on the bill that's coming up, there will be an amendment. It'll be offered by Senators Brown and Kaufman. That's Brown of Ohio, not Massachusetts. And that amendment will be the test. Will the Democratic Party be able to transcend its ties to these to this industry and vote for a bill that would effectively begin to break these companies up?
Jane, I want to mention one thing about Tone, which is he has to walk a very fine line at this point. You know, we're at a point in the economy where it's still very fragile. So he does not want to spook markets. He has to say, I love free markets. I love money. I love growth. It's just you're not going to get a free ride. So talking to Main Street and Wall Street at the same time, I think, is one reason we didn't see quite the bellicose tone that some people might have expected.
We have solidified our line to Ed Luce, who's a Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Ed, welcome. Better late than never. Thanks for being here.
Kind of you to have me.
Thank you. Let's get right to you. Democrats say that this financial reform legislation will bring the sharpest regulatory crackdowns on banks and markets since the 1930s. Help us understand more specifically what exactly is in this legislation.
Quite a lot. I mean, the new resolution authority, which would enable regulators to wind down and close down any kind of financial institution, not just banks, as is the authority they have now, is clearly a new power that recognizes the post-Glass-Steagall, the post-late 1990s realities, rather belatedly. Discretion to impose much higher capital ratios, much higher capital charges on the largest institutions. In other words, to reduce their leverage ratios from the sort of 30-to-1 debt equity ratio you saw in the build up to the crisis down to it's discretionary, but presumably down to something more like 12 or 15-to-1. That's quite a big step. The charging of regulators with the authority to look more broadly at systemic risk is another innovation. That was something that no single regulator prior to now was responsible for doing, and therefore people missed the wood from the trees. And finally, in terms of picking out the highlights, the pushing of derivatives trading, or at least plain vanilla derivatives trading, depending on which version of these various bills we've got on the Hill you look at, onto central counterparty clearinghouses, is designed to try and increase transparency in the most toxic, dangerous portion of the market. I don't think it's remotely comparable, however, to the very radical overhaul that you saw in the 1930s. I don't think it belongs on the same page. This is making the existing system safer. What happened in the 30s was that FDR and Congress overhauled the system entirely.
Here's in his speech yesterday a bit from President Obama, talking about and rejecting Republican claims that the financial reform package on the Hill will lead to more bailouts. Nice soundbite, he said, but not the truth.
These changes have the added benefit of creating incentives within the industry to ensure that no one company can ever threaten to bring down the whole economy. To that end, the bill would also enact what's known as the Volcker Rule. And there's a tall guy sitting in the front row here, Paul Volcker, who we named it after. And it does something very simple. It places some limits on the size of banks and the kinds of risks that banking institutions can take.
Diane Brady, what do you make of the Volcker Rule and, more broadly, the substance of this proposed reform?
You know, one place you could look is Canada, which the banking system there does have the types of limits that the Volcker Rule, not all of them, but certainly in terms of the amount of leverage you can take on. I think that most people think it is a good idea. One of the issues clearly has been too big to fail. One of the issues has been proprietary trading, you know, some conflicts of interest, and the amount of leverage that people were allowed to take on. So I think that, you know, is it supported in the banking community? Probably not. But most people think inherently the Volcker Rule makes sense. Republicans clearly have been trying to characterize this as leading to more bailouts, but I think that's just politics. At this point, everyone wants to say that they are the ones that are going to prevent this from happening again.
Speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, GOP Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that Democrats' attempts at financial reform may not end the possibility of more bailouts for banks. McConnell signaled this week that he was willing to engage in more negotiations, but said that any bill must prevent bailouts.
If this bill didn't do anything else but that, a lot of people would be satisfied. The administration said it wants to end bailouts. I say to them, prove it.
Jack Beatty, how do you read the GOP's maneuvering here?
They've really gone a distance since last week. Senator McConnell introduced this talking point about this the Democrats' resolution authority, essentially a formula for putting banks out of their misery, for closing them down, that would be supported by attacks from the industry, that this would somehow perpetuate bailouts. In fact, it's just the opposite. It would end the companies. However, he is raising a good substantive question, which is, does this bill allow the existence of institutions that are too big to fail? And I think the answer is yes, if five banks have 60% of the gross domestic product.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the week's top stories. Joining me this hour is Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, Ed Luce of the Financial Times, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go right to the phones. Listener Peter is calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. Hi, Peter. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I understand and agree with Jack that the financial reform legislation does not do enough. But I don't think that's a reason for folks not to support it or for Democrats not to push as hard as they can to pass it, even in the form that it is now. I would say it's not dissimilar from health care, where I was certainly not pleased with the final result and wanted to have a public plan and a lot more to control costs. But I do think that we're much better off as a country with that having been passed than we would have been without it. And politics aside, and also I actually recently met James Kwok, who is the co-author of Simon Johnson's book, who Jack was referring to, and asked him that same question about, is it worth passing, you know, a bill that's not, doesn't fix all the problems in this case? And he strongly said that he thought they should pass what was being considered now, even though he acknowledges some of those same shortcomings.
Peter, thank you very much. Peter's call brings me to this point, Ed Luce. What's not in this bill that perhaps should be?
Well, the Simon Johnson argument to which your caller referred, and Kwok argument that in their book 13 Banks, Bankers, argues that this bill singularly fails to reduce the size of the big banks, and that in doing so will set itself up for the next crash or the next big bailout, and all the moral hazard that comes with being too big to fail. I think the response to that argument is, look at, as Diane mentioned, look at Canada. It's got a lot of big banks, and but it's got a safe banking system. It's got a utility-like banking system, which didn't get involved in the sort of credit default swap culture. And Canada's come off from the global financial crisis least scathed amongst the major economies. The other argument is that if America on its own reduced the size of banks without other countries, particularly in Europe and East Asia, doing the same, then you would make America vulnerable, American smaller banks, relative by then, smaller banks vulnerable to take over by the behemoths across the Atlantic, and that therefore you would need a global agreement to reduce the size of banks, which of course is barely imaginable. I think a more a related but slightly different aim would be to reduce the size of the financial sector vis-a-vis to the American economy as a whole. But that's much more difficult to achieve. It would involve a direct attack on the profitability of Wall Street, and it would involve a sort of bare knuckles lobbying fight in Washington that I don't think the Democrats are prepared to have.
Diane Brady, do you agree, or what's your response to the question, what's not in this bill that should be?
Well, I think the size question is definitely one that people have raised, and I do think, Canada's a model that you don't have to do that. Some people feel that it's very hard to stay ahead of the next innovation on Wall Street. I mean, could we have seen synthetic CDOs, for example, coming? And people are worried about how do you get ahead of the next product. Certainly, transparency is going to help, but the reality is that they are not really trying to limit what Wall Street does and how they make their money. They just simply want to put some structure around it, and they want to put some consequence around it, certainly around pay and certainly around the idea that when you fail, in fact, you do fail.
Here's some sound about the politics of all this. Speaking to reporters yesterday on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he is willing to hear the Republican side of this on financial reform, but he says time is running out.
If they are willing to go forward with reform, that's what we'll do. But I'm not going to waste any more time with the American people until they come up with some agreement.
Ed Luce, there's an important vote set for Monday. Explain to us why it's important and where Republicans will show their intentions and how.
Well, this is the first of what will be several filibuster opportunities for the Republicans. It's simply a motion to bring the debate to the floor of the Senate. There are 3 days between now and Monday evening, and of course, in that period, Harry Reid and Chris Dodd could pull off an agreement with a minority of Republicans in order to overcome a filibuster, or indeed the politics coming from the country or from the Tea Party movement could persuade a minority of Republicans on their own that it would be bad for them and bad for their re-election prospects in November to be seen to be opposing Wall Street reform. Mm-hmm. There are a number of scenarios. This is a fluid situation. The politics is going the Democratic way, but that by no means makes it a predictable moment. It's going to be a fascinating and very telling moment, but there's still quite a lot of fluidity.
Jack Beatty, do you foresee a Republican filibuster?
I don't. I think that the politics are, in fact, going in the Democrats' way. And, in fact, I think if they had their ideal, it would be to have a filibuster. That would give them an issue that would allow them to, for the first time in over a year, to sort of have a strong populist issue. I don't think the Republicans want to give them that. And on the Republican side, there are people like Bob Corker from Tennessee who has done prodigies of work on this bill, and it was he who disarmed Senator McConnell's feckless criticism about the bailout fund and so on. He said, no, that's not true. And I watched speeches of him, of his this week, and it's just painfully clear that he wants to vote for this bill, having sweated so hard on it. And I think that's true of others, too. And on the Agriculture Committee, for the first time, there were no votes for reform in the House. There now is one vote for one part of reform. On the Agriculture Committee, Senator Grassley voted for the derivatives regulation.
Here's Republican Representative John Boehner yesterday saying that President Obama's finance reform bill will continue to prop up the very institutions that helped fuel the financial crisis.
While the president says he wants to reform Wall Street, the bill that we have in front of us will actually provide permanent bailouts for Wall Street and enshrine too big to fail.
Representative John Boehner there. Diane Brady, what's your take on the Republicans' next move?
Well, I think they understand the zeitgeist of the country at this point. Yes, they're going to make some noise. Republicans, you know, they like to characterize Democrats as being basically trying to strangle financial markets and not doing enough. And Democrats like to characterize Republicans as being in the service of Wall Street. But the reality is both sides have been pretty disgusted with what they've seen regarding pay. Both sides are unhappy with bailouts, and both sides understand they have to give the other enough concessions to make it work, and that this is what Americans want, and they're very aware of that fact.
Well, the financial reform debate in Washington, of course, comes in the midst of the SEC civil lawsuit against Goldman Sachs. Here's some sound. Goldman Sachs under fire this week after being accused of doctoring their books, using unethical loopholes to hide their true financial state. Greg Palm, general counsel for the bank, said in a conference call that they had not lied to investors.
We would never intentionally mislead anyone, certainly not our clients or our counterparties. We have never condoned and would never condone inappropriate behavior by any of our people.
Greg Palm, general counsel for Goldman Sachs. Our number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Diane Brady, how does this fight look now with the Goldman Sachs element inserted?
Well, I think that, whether or not they did something illegal is open to debate. But certainly, you know, they've been wrestling with this vampire squid motif for the better part of a year. They've been involved in helping Greece basically disguise its debt to get into the European community. They definitely had a link to AIG. So they're suffering a lot on the reputation front. And now to basically be seen to have been selling a product that they were both betting against and let a short seller, John Paulson, have some control is the allegation over the products that went into that. So basically designing something that was going to fail and then selling it to clients. I think reputationally it's going to be very, very hard for them to bounce back from this. But what I don't think it'll do is actually affect the profitability of Goldman Sachs. You saw they had a fantastic quarter.
Right.
I would guess going forward that will continue.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the timing of this SEC lawsuit and how it's affected this debate in Washington?
Well, Daryl Issa, I think the ranking or one of the ranking Republicans on the banking committee in the House charges that there's something, there's some coordination here between the SEC and the administration, because obviously this scandal coming just as the debate on financial reform reaches apogee, that this is, suspect timing. Well, apparently it isn't, according to the New York Times, which looked into this. This had been in the works for some time. But there's no doubt that the timing is fortuitous. And I think that that there's going to be a Tuesday's hearing where these people from Goldman are going to have to testify. It is going to be one of those occasions when they may feel what Irving Goffman once called rituals of degradation. They're going to be subjected to more hypocritical finger wagging on the part of politicians who've taken their dime than you can imagine. And I think that Goldman's campaign contributions will themselves become toxic assets. Already, candidates are saying, oh, I'm going to give it back. I'm not going to take it. And I think even the Democratic National Committee eventually is going to be forced to say, no, we can't take their money.
Ed Luce, where do you see public support falling for financial reform in Washington?
Well, I think there's a sort of general public feeling that you need to rein in Wall Street. I don't think it's much more specific than that. There's been an interesting debate going on this week amongst people who read polls very closely and pass the polls. And one distinction in public attitudes that's been found is between antipathy towards Wall Street and general friendliness towards banks. In other words, when you use the word Wall Street, you get an emotive response that is strongly negative. When you conjure up an image of your local community bank, people are far friendlier in their attitudes. And the administration has very, I think, skillfully changed its language on financial re-regulation to just now always referring to it as Wall Street reform. And I think, that speaks to their careful passing of these very same polls.
Ed Luce, I'm curious, what is the view of the Obama presidency in Washington more broadly, and more specifically, how do people in the White House see the president's actions right now?
See the president's actions right now on
and his in his agenda and how he's laying things out. I mean, he seems to be doing a lot, but not getting a lot of public recognition for it, at least in the polls.
No, there's a little bit of a bifurcation there between, you know, the applause he's getting here in Washington, D.C. for what, you know, is becoming an increasingly skillful and confident performance by the president in the aftermath of healthcare. And the fact that, you know, his numbers, his approval ratings have remained pretty much exactly where they were before healthcare was reformed. There's clearly a difference in perception between the political class, the Beltway class, and Joe Public. And I think Joe Public, you know, is concerned, as it always has been, and probably should be, with the economic outlook for the economy. And the real test of for them of whether President Obama is performing is on something he can do relatively little about, which is unemployment and new job creation. There is very, very little the president can do to affect that between now and November.
Jack Beattie, I'm curious what your thoughts are, the perception of President Obama's performance so far.
Well, he does seem to be on a roll, doesn't he? I mean, historic health care reform, a START agreement, and people in Mr. Luce's own paper were saying, being diplomats, saying that his victory at home on health care has helped him abroad. And now right on the verge of a major, major change in financial regulation. Not the ideal change, not, I think, the change the crisis needs, but clearly, and I agree with Peter, a step forward. Yes, success, and yet out in the country, a lag. And I think Ed puts his finger right on the reason, the continual sluggish economy and the stubborn unemployment rate, which actually may get worse before it gets better as more and more people come into the workforce who've been essentially out of it. So that's what's going to measure the success or failure of his party in the fall. And, you know, when you look at that, things look very bad for the Democrats. I saw Charlie Cook today has some data showing what the public thought about in 1994 and in 2006, years when there were big swings of control in the House, and the Democrats are so much worse now than either the Democrats were in 1994 when they lost over 50 seats, or than the Republicans were in 2006. The Democrats are way worse in terms of the ratings for Congress. So it could be a very bad year for them.
Ed Luce made reference to some of these numbers. Diane Brady, I want to get you in here before the break. Economic numbers at home are out this week. Existing home sales rising 6.8% in March. First-time jobless claims have dropped. There's new sign of economic recovery in the U.S. auto industry. Sales surged 47% in the first quarter. Diane Brady, how do you see these numbers playing into the state of the U.S. economy?
Well, it's very good timing for Obama, obviously. We are seeing a pickup, but you're also seeing persistent unemployment. People who have been out of work for longer than 6 months, that remains troubling. And I think the other thing is service cuts. You know, people talk about trickle down, but there really is a trickle up. Reputational hit the president takes when people are starting to see less funding to their schools, less services in terms of pickup. The states are hard-pressed. Everybody's trying to cut costs right now. So, yes, the economy's picking up, hiring's picking up, but these lag. And in terms of the actual day-to-day realities that most people are facing, I think they're still essentially looking to Washington and not very happy with their lot.
Ed Luce, do you agree?
Yeah, yes, I'd agree. I mean, you know, the ultimate measure, you know, is that people do see the president as the commander-in-chief of the economy, as well as the commander-in-chief. And I think, the president has a great deal more ability to shift around the military than he does unemployment numbers. And he will be punished by that, for that, in November, even if he doesn't deserve to be.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. Some other stories this week. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell suspended Pittsburgh Steelers star quarterback Ben Roethlisberger for 6 games. Goodell said it had to be done.
You know, there's enough out there that reflects very poorly on him as an individual, the Steelers, every player in the NFL and the NFL in general, and that's troublesome.
Vice President Joe Biden appeared on The View on ABC. Here's Whoopi Goldberg getting a straight answer to her tax question.
When you look at how much taxation is going on in this country, you know, I've been kvetching about this from the beginning because I don't mind paying taxes.
You have a lot of money. That's why it bothers you. I'm joking.
And Jon Stewart solved the problem of every broadcaster this week, including me, having to say that difficult-to-pronounce name of the Iceland volcano.
Volcano, I think I'll call you Kevin. Does anybody know the volcano's name?
Sounds good to a lot of us around here. Let's turn to the Florida Senate race. New twists and turns as Charlie Crist is looking at some other options for himself. This week, Florida Senate candidate Mark Rubio got some high-profile endorsements from former Vice President Dick Cheney, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Here he is rallying voters in Florida this week. Rubio says America needs to stay an exceptional nation.
But now I believe we are living at a time when the people who run this country, the people in charge in the White House and in Congress, are asking us to abandon all the things that have made this possible and exchange it for something more like the rest of the world. In essence, what this election is about is a choice. Do we want to continue to be exceptional, or are we prepared to become like everybody else?
Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek, Ed Luce, Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic, our panel this hour. Jack Beatty, what do you read about what's going on in Florida?
Well, it appears that Governor Crist will file as an independent so that you'll have 3 candidates, a Democrat, Kendrick Meeks, a young African-American candidate from South Florida, congressman, Mr. Rubio, and the governor. And the conventional wisdom would be that the three candidates will split the Republican vote, advantaging the Democrat. That could happen. Today, there's some analysis that doesn't look as likely as initially seemed, because perhaps the support to Crist won't be that strong. The wild card here is that the Republicans look set to nominate someone who has a cloud over him. There's an IRS investigation of Mr. Rubio about his use of credit cards as the Speaker of the House in Florida. He was using Republican Party credit cards to pay for his living expenses, and there's some question, did he declare this considerable sum of money on his income taxes or not? And you know, you could have a situation where he will be a tainted candidate in November.
But the national significance of the Crist Rubio play?
Well, I mean, here you see a candidate who was extremely hot with the Tea Party faction of the Republican Party, and I think we have to emphasize that. More and more we find out the Tea Party is a faction of the right wing of the Republican Party. But their enthusiasm for him propelled him over in a 30-point gain in a year over what seemed to be a pretty strong candidacy for Governor Crist. And the big problem for Crist was he did what was right for Florida. He took stimulus money from the Obama administration and embraced the president, and that was death to this faction of the GOP.
Ed Luce, can Charlie Crist win as an independent, and how do you see this as a sort of national bellwether?
I think it's too early to say whether he can win, and I haven't been down there recently. I do intend to rectify that soon, because Florida is clearly sort of grand central, as it were, for the Tea Party movement. This is where the most excitement's being generated. People are even talking about Rubio as a potential 2012 presidential candidate, and thus it's no surprise to see the sort of lagging hopefuls like Mitt Romney endorse him with such warmth and emphasis. I do think, though, that there is always a potential burnout factor here with such a meteoric rise. And Jack's mention of this IRS investigation is, I think, something we're going to be hearing more of in the next few weeks.
To this point, here's Cookeville, Tennessee, Jerry with the thought. Jerry, welcome to On Point. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I'd like to say about the investigation to Marco Rubio, I think that would be like seeing the president's ties with Tony Rescue on his deal he got with his home. I don't think there'll be a whole lot found. At least I don't think it will be found that way. But I think Marco Rubio, the reason people are pulling towards him is because he is a conservative, and so many Republicans claim to be conservatives when they run, but then when they show up, that they're anything but a conservative. And I think people have found that out to be quite true with Governor Crist down there. So I don't think that even if he does run as a third party candidate, I think Rubio will be the next senator out of Florida.
Jerry, thanks for your call. A story we'll keep watching. I want to turn now to General Motors, because CEO Ed Whitaker announced this week that the company had paid off its government bailout loans 5 years ahead of schedule. GM made a $5.4 billion payment to the Treasury Department in addition to a $1.1 billion payment to the Canadian government, and previous payments closing out $7.8 billion in total loans. Whitaker shot a one-minute-long commercial release this week inviting taxpayers, as he says, to take a look at the new GM.
I'm Ed Whitaker from General Motors. A lot of Americans didn't agree with giving GM a second chance. Quite frankly, I can respect that. We want to make this a company all Americans can be proud of again. That's why I'm here to announce we have repaid our government loan in full with interest, 5 years ahead of the original schedule.
Diane Brady, how does the good news for American car companies feed into the larger economic recovery story here?
Well, I think certainly one thing you can't forget is the problems that Toyota has been facing and how much that brand has been damaged by, the sticking pedals and the like. So that's one factor. But clearly, people are starting to buy cars again, in part because the incentives are still there. But I think they have got their house in order. They've been able to push off some of the debt they had. They were coming from a very low base, and I think it is heartening. You look at Ford has been doing very well. So overall, people see this as another signal that the economy, even if the recovery is fragile, it's on its way.
Ed Luce, how do you see it?
I don't have much to add to what Diane has just said. Clearly, the Toyota thing was critical. It is remarkable, though, if you think back just a few months ago, we were all joking about government motors. That joke, can't be used for the foreseeable future. And I think it is a measure of how quickly things can turn around when you get government support.
I want to turn now to this huge disaster off New Orleans. Here's Coast Guard Rear Admiral Mary Landry talking in a news conference yesterday that much is still unknown about the huge oil rig explosion earlier this week. She says the search for 11 people known to be on the rig continues and that the water is being tested to find out exactly how much crude oil escaped into the ocean.
Right now we have observed from the air a 1-mile by 5-mile sheen of crude oil. A crude oil mix and light sheening, rainbow sheening. This is not a 1-by-5-mile concentration of crude oil. This is a rainbow sheen with a dark center that we presume to be a crude oil mix.
A story over the AP wire just a few moments ago says the Coast Guard says it doesn't appear that any oil is leaking from the drilling rig that exploded, but they're still looking at it. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this spill and any larger implications beyond the obvious tragedy?
Well, yes. The Obama administration is talking about wants to open up more of these leases off other areas of our coastline. And this comes at a moment when, that is out there. And one of the objections to that is, well, my gosh, you'll have accidents and you'll have pollution and you'll have beaches that look like the Indianapolis 500 and you'll have dead species and so on. Environmental depredation, and I think that's what we're seeing here, or we could well see, and it's not good timing, it seems to me, for the administration in that larger argument, which has been, oh, we're very safe, these things never happen. Well, they just did.
1-800-423-8255 is our number, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to the phones. Michelle is on the line from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hello. Fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
Yes. Actually, my comments had more to do with the original discussion about the financial reform.
Okay.
My biggest concerns are about Republicans and Democrats working together and making sure that they don't rush the financial reform like I feel the health care reform was, where they just want to get something passed and they don't want to really put in strict regulation. I want to make sure that with this financial reform, they're eliminating practices and not just capping risk, because the practices that need to be eliminated are ones that only benefit the upper class of the United States and those practices. The failure this time around for this recession, you know, impacts the mid and lower class as far as their jobs, where the upper class, yes, of course, they're impacted because they were involved in those kinds of products, but at the same time, they haven't lost their job. They aren't struggling to put food on the table. And so I really want to make sure that this reform does enough.
Michelle, thank you. Diane Brady, Michelle wants to make sure that it does enough, and she doesn't want to rush into reform. What do you say?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to acknowledge that the financial services sector did take a huge hit. Now, obviously, were they struggling to put food on the table? No, but a lot of people did lose their jobs from the carnage on Wall Street. I think that there's a limit to how ambitious you can be, and I think it gets back to what we've seen in Florida and everywhere else, is there's this real polarization of sentiment in Washington and in this country, and to find that middle ground where you can actually get things passed means by necessity that you're not going to be quite as bold and quite as ambitious as either side would want you to be. This is something, putting the structures in place will make people happy. I think certainly anything to do with executive pay is going to resonate throughout this country. But they also do not want to kill the golden goose. They understand that you need relatively free financial markets. And we're also in a global economy, as Ed said. You do something to the banks here, there are plenty of banks in other places. It is a seamless system worldwide, and there's a limit to how much you can really control what's going on.
In our last few minutes here, I want to head overseas, because the big story in the Middle East this week was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu again rejecting U.S. calls to halt construction in occupied East Jerusalem. He spoke as U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell was arriving in the region for separate talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Ed Luce, what do you make of this latest development?
Well, that's unsurprising. I think what's more interesting in terms of the last 24 hours on the Arab-Israeli front happened right here, in New York, rather. Chuck Schumer gave an interview yesterday to a relatively conservative Jewish show, in which he said that it really issued a very strong warning to the administration not to continue to air its differences with Netanyahu's government in public. Said that he had called Rahm Emanuel a few weeks ago after Hillary Clinton had telephoned Netanyahu and essentially read Netanyahu the riot act. And Senator Schumer called, as he put it yesterday, Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, White House chief of staff, a month ago, and warned him that if this kind of rhetoric from the administration continued on Israel, that he would take it public and blast the administration and take it up to the next step. He also said that there was a battle going on within the administration over Arab-Israeli policy. Now, you know, notwithstanding the usual sort of discount you apply to some of Senator Schumer's words, he can be quite wordy sometimes. I do think that this statement's significant. There's a battle also going on within Washington to try and on the one hand persuade the president to stick with this process, however bleak its outlook might be, and on the other to try and climb down from this process because it's considered to be undermining America's closest ally, mainly
Israel. Jack Beattie, how do you see it in Washington?
And I think there's also a split between Congress generally and the administration, isn't there, Ed? I mean, I've seen there was a letter signed by, 366 members of the House and several score senators saying essentially what Schumer says, please cool the rhetoric with Israel. And I think that's the problem. The president can't, you know, he really can't make any credible threats here to Israel in terms of aid and so on with Congress against him. And it seems as if they're ready to double down here, almost as if they're tired of arguing over this relative minutia. And when it keeps hearing stories, they're ready for a big plan. The president is ready to say, here's what the United States wants, and actually to name conditions and you know, what we want to do about the right of return, about Jerusalem, about all these issues. And that will be an extraordinary moment in American-Israeli, our whole relations in the Middle East, but particularly with our ally. Mm.
Let's end the program with where we started it, financial reform on the table in Washington. Diane Brady, what do you expect next week?
I think that this will ultimately succeed. As I said, I think there's enough psychic goodwill on both sides that they understand the need to have something. Will it be as ambitious as we want? Probably not. But the good news is that the economy is heading in the right direction. And I think one reason they want something now is they are worried that the momentum will be lost.
Ed Luce, your final thoughts?
I'd agree with that. I think that the key sort of turning point in a way was on Wednesday of this week when Chuck Grassley, as Jack mentioned earlier, Chuck Grassley voted for a very robust form of derivatives regulation on the agricultural, on Blanche Lincoln's committee. I think that was really the turning point. I do think there'll be Republican support for this bill.
And Jack Beatty, 10 seconds for your final word.
It's a good argument for having elections. Chuck Grassley's on the ballot, so is Blanche Lincoln, and we have a tough bill.
Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor for The Atlantic. Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ed Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Ed, thank you very much for your time today.
Many thanks for having me.
And Diane Brady, senior editor for Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Also find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.